here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Thanks, as always, to Kipper the Cat, keeping the studio both warm and really cool, man, as we sidle in here behind the mic to bring you this evening's Evening Under Lamplight on the famous Cambridge 105 radio, community radio in your city. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and I invite you to attend. We continue our journey with Dante down through the levels of the Inferno, this week attending to the ditch containing the flatterers. So we'll be looking at various kinds of flattery. We spent two shows talking about Dante's encounter with the seducers and pimps, but that episode does not even take up a whole canto in the Inferno. There's another episode that finishes things off. The final 33 lines of Canto 18 describe the bolgia, or ditch, containing the flatterers. Dante and Virgil pause for a short while to examine these people. So shall we. Everything in Dante is connected, so we want to ask why he moves from seduction to flattery. What do these two things have in common? Well, remember that this is the part of hell dedicated to sins of deception. Here are the souls of people who have deceived other people in order to promote their own ends. And so the seducer deceives the other person by pretending to be passionately in love with the other and thus arouses the other person's passion in return. But there's no interchange of love here. The seducer's love, as we heard the miracles sing, was just a mirage. The seducer uses passion in order to get the other person to do what the seducer wants. Or the pimp, who doesn't even get sexual pleasure from the other person's arousal, just money. And now we find those who deceived others with flattery, through words rather than sexual passion. I think this is more common, and more insidious, certainly, hence its position lower down in the order of hell. I want something from you, so I give you the words you want to hear. I don't believe them, of course, but I act like I do. My words are false, but if you believe me, you'll be putty in my hands. You will do what I want. Or you will do what I want. On a very simple level, we have the yes men, those people, not just men, who always praise their boss's ideas and policies and achievements. They know that their boss is so vain that the boss will not even question this praise, but will enjoy it and want to have their yes man around all the time. Why, in fact, let's promote him or her. Well, the yes man is doing it for self-advancement, that's all. The words mean nothing, but the boss is too thick to see that. Politicians always supporting their leader in order to achieve a good position in the party are like this too. And if the boss is some egocentric maniac who considers only flattering words to be real news and all the rest fake news, then by flattering this man, you'll be sitting pretty. At least for as long as this insane person still holds power. But wait, Wait, let's not confuse this with a more innocent kind of flattery. I'm still trying to deceive you with my flattering words, but I'm doing it to spare your feelings, not to use you for my own ends. You've just served me a meal that I said was delicious, even though I had to go through 3 glasses of wine to help me get the stuff down. I'm deceiving you when I say it was a delicious meal, yes, but only to make you feel good after all the effort you put into making the meal. Or you ask me whether the dress you finally decided on looks good for the party tonight, and I say, yes, it does, even though I don't think it looks that good. But I know what a bad week you've had and how long it's taken you to find something to wear, and I know that we really have to get going. And anyway, these are just our close friends. Your self-esteem has taken a battering the past few days, and being told you look good will give you that boost that will make you look better than even the best clothes will. So I deceive you. But I do it for your own sake, out of concern for you, not me. It's still deceit, and thus not true, but I don't think I end up in the inferno for this. My motive was love, relationship, not selfishness. It's not a hellish act. Let's remember this. But let's also stop for a song. You'll recognize it from the first few notes, but we might want to ask, is it about flattery? And if so, what kind of flattery? Attend, and let's see.
Son of a gun. Strategically dipped below.
You're So Vain from Carly Simon. The song gets more interesting the more we look at it. First of all, there are the wonderful, precise and cutting images. You walked into the party like you were walking onto a yacht. And how do you walk onto a yacht? With a careful, self-conscious step and a sort of bounce as the boat rises and falls in the water, which easily merges into a kind of swagger. After all, who walks onto a yacht but someone who feels especially privileged? So here you are, walking into the party with the nonchalance of someone who regards himself as the unquestioned most important person. You can see, can't you, how hard I'm trying not to make every reference here fall back to Trump. Your hat is tilted at an angle. That's fine. I often tilt my hat at an angle, too, after all. Sometimes it's a good way to keep the sun out of my eyes. Sometimes it's the only way to keep the hat from blowing off in the wind. But you, Mr. Vane, you have your hat dipped below one eye, and you've done this strategically. You've worked at your appearance. You're not for real, just propped up. And the apricot scarf, the kind of odd accessory people would notice. But look how she sets up the line. Your scarf, it was apricot, putting all the emphasis on that final word, also with its classy pronunciation of apricot. And of course, one eye on the mirror as you strut around as though going through the motions of a stately gavotte dance. And did all the girls dream that they'd be your partner, or was this just the way you perceived it? Never mind. You're so vain. Well, we knew that from all the details we've been given so far. And what's the ultimate vanity? Well, that you think this song is about you, right? Even though it's mocking you, that doesn't matter. Every song has to be about you. And so let's ask again, is this flattery? Well, in a sense, no, it's not, because it's not deceitful, is it? She says he's vain, and she means it, and it's the truth. She's telling the truth, but she's also telling this truth in a way that he will interpret as a compliment. That's the way of vanity and of flattery. The vain person is open to all kinds of flattery, even when it's not really flattery. You see what I mean about how complicated this song can get? I'll skip over the rest of the song. Attend to it again yourself and see how it works. We've taken a wee digression from Dante and the Flatterers, but we'll get back on topic now. Now, to recap, we've seen that flattery is the use of words to butter up another person so you can use them for your own ends. It's a form of deceit, control, and self-serving all at once. Flattery, thus, is the opposite of true communication, in which we use words as a medium of exchange, to share something with others. Exchanging words is a kind of game, like tennis. I send some words over to you, and you have to reach to get the words and send something back to me in exchange. This can be strenuous, but I'm not trying to get you to miss the ball, just to exert yourself as I exert myself for you. Oh, just another outdoor game, as Robert Frost says, one on a side. In fact, let's shift the metaphor from a game of tennis to the task of digging up buried treasure, perhaps. As Stevenson famously put it, well, famous to me anyway, the speaker buries his meaning. It's for the hearer to dig it up again. And all speech, written or spoken, is in a dead language until it finds a willing and prepared hearer. And we hope that this willing and prepared hearer will be able to dig what we're saying. But the flatterer hopes the hearer will be vain enough just to sit back and be pleased by what I say, never bothering to do the hard work of digging, and thus be so disarmed that I can do whatever I want with him or her. Thus there's no communication, no exchange, no relationship, and that is the nature of Dante's hell. So how does Dante describe this ditch of flattery? First come the sounds as they get a little closer. We heard the whimpering of people snuffling with their snouts and beating on themselves with their own palms. And when Dante and Virgil come right up to the banks of this ditch, we get images of sight. They can see that the banks are coated with some kind of slimy mold. And then the images of smell. Dante and Virgil are assaulted by stinking vapors rising up from whatever is contained below. And what is contained below? The pit is so deep that Dante and Virgil can't make out what is at the bottom until they climb all the way to the middle of the bridge spanning this ditch. And now Dante can see what it is. These souls are immersed in... Well, no. Oh, wait a minute. I'd better give a warning here. We're about to use crude language to describe this crude image. And I think it was the Scottish poet Gavin Douglas who said, "Because the matter been so vile, I may not use an ornate style." Because I'm talking about filthy things, I have to use a filthy style. As does Dante, whose language here is as crude as his matter. Anyway, Dante looks down into the ditch and sees that the souls are immersed in shit. Or as Robin Kirkpatrick puts it, more disgustingly, I think, than even Dante puts it, all of them were plunged in diarrhea, flowing, it seemed, from human cubicles. So that's the fate of the flatterers. And as we've seen all along, the image that Dante gives us expresses the nature of the sin. Flatterers, as we say, are full of shit. Merdosi, as Dante would put it. Their words mean nothing. And remember that Dante was a writer. Words were his medium. And those who ruined his medium now wallow in the stinking mess they themselves have made of this medium. Dante, as we know, is on this journey to see these images of sin so that he can recognize them in himself and purify himself. And so here he is, peering down into that nasty mess to see if there's anyone he recognizes. Yes, there is. A man, si di merda lordo, so smeared in shit that Dante can't tell if his head is shaved like a cleric or not. This is Alessio in Terminae, someone Dante knew back in the upper world. We have a description of this man from a contemporary, and he sounds pretty foul. Well, this Alessio, our source tells us, had a terrible habit. He was so given to flattery that he was unable to say anything at all without seasoning it with the oil of adulation. He greased everyone. He licked everyone, even the most vile and venal servants. In short, he completely dripped with flattery and stank of it. That's good, isn't it? That flattery has transformed itself into the shit that now drips off him and that he stinks of. How could anyone have believed anything he said? And if they couldn't believe him, of what use was he to the community?
Beautiful. God, it's God, I say God.
Yes.
okay, a little bit of the Mothers of Invention and their nasal, retentive calliope music from the album We're Only In It for the Money. Suitably shitty music for Alessio Interminai. I've always wondered how I'd get a chance to play this on the show, but it fits fine here, even that little fart at the end. By the way, you're listening to Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, or as the man says,
when the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105. Community radio in your city.
Thank you. Virgil now turns Dante's attention to another person down here in the shit. This is Thais, a character in the play Eunuchus by the Latin writer Terence. Thais is a courtesan, a high-class prostitute, who's being kept by Thraso. Dante gets the story from Cicero, who uses Thais to illustrate the principle that any friendship is empty if one of the people doesn't want to hear the truth and the other person is ready to lie. Think again in this context of fake news and alternative facts, which work only because some people do not want to hear the truth and others are quite ready to lie. Thus, the relationship between these parties is empty, full of shit. I think I'll tell this one too. I'm thinking of a shameful moment in the European division of a large American university when the guest speaker at the graduation ceremony was an important German diplomat who spoke to these American residents in Europe on some of the reasons many Europeans disliked or distrusted America. It was an incisive talk and meant not to give offense, but to enlighten. There was a great uproar afterwards, though, as the students protested that this was their special day and they wanted a talk that made them feel good, not one that made them think. Even though, of course, this was the day they were officially declaring themselves bona fide university graduates, that is, certified thinkers. But no, thinking was too hard, and it uncovered some things that made them uncomfortable. They wanted to be flattered instead. After the fuss, the university stopped inviting anyone who might challenge the students to think. Instead, there were speakers who flattered. You have achieved great things, all you students, and the whole world is open to you. Walk proud, because you've earned the right to feel good about yourself. That sort of thing. Flattery. Dante shows us what is really going on at these moments. But back to Thais, another example of flattery. Dante gives us a mixed-up version of her story, but that's not the point. The way he tells it is that Thraso sent Thais a present, of a slave, as it turned out, and asked if she was sending him many thanks for this present. And instead of saying just many thanks in return, which would have been enough to say, she told him she was sending him millions of thanks. She's trying to butter him up rather than speak the truth. This seems like a pretty trivial example, but it gets its deeper significance from Cicero's use of it to illustrate an empty relationship, the chief characteristic of hell. But look at what Thais is doing here. With her hair all disheveled and wild, she's down there scratching herself with unghie merdose, shitty fingernails, squatting down, rising up, squatting down, rising up. That's an odd image, even more vivid in Mark Musso's looser version, where she is spreading her legs while squatting up and down. I haven't seen any commentator remark on her actions, but here's what occurred to me when I was reading this again recently. Dante does not specify where she is scratching herself, but could it be that with her hair all wild, legs apart, squirming up and down, could she be working herself up, hands there between her legs, like some sort of cheap girly show where the desperate man pays to watch a woman masturbating, though of course she's doing no such thing, only pretending to bring herself off. And listen, isn't this the dirtiest kind of flattery? Deceiving the poor, pathetic man into thinking he's so sexy that the woman becomes uncontrollably orgasmic as soon as he shows up? He probably thinks that song is about him. I'll just leave you with this interpretation. It's only hypothetical. But it fits Dante's description, doesn't it? Well, now we need a song. Sure, a song about a woman flattering a man by pretending he's so sexy that she has to scratch her itching till she comes. Yeah, sure, there's lots of songs about this, right? Well, not in my collection, I'm afraid. But how about this from the Zombies? She's not there. The woman in the song lied, perhaps through flattery, though we're not told. No one told him about her, and now it's too late to do anything about it. She's not there. She's dipped into shit in the inferno instead, perhaps. Her voice was soft and cool. Her eyes were clear and bright. But she's not there. It's all a front, a deceit. Full of shit, yes?
Well, no one told me about her, the way she lied. Well, no one told me about her, how many people cried. But it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked. The way she had tanned the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool. Her eyes were clear and bright. But she's not there. Well, no one told me about her. What could I do? Well, no one told me about. They all knew, but it's too late to say you're sorry. How would I know? Why should I care? Please don't bother trying to find her. She's not there. Well, let me tell you about the way she looked, the way she acted, the color of her hair. Her voice was soft and cool, her eyes were clear and bright, but she's not there.
Zombies, she's not there. Now, for the final segment of our show this evening, Under Lamplight, I want to share with you a witty and relevant discussion that appeared many years ago, the late 50s or early 60s, in an article by the Harvard sociologist William G. Perry. The article has the wonderful title, Examsmanship and the Liberal Arts, A Study in Educational Epistemology. What he means is that he's going to look at taking exams as a kind of game that reveals our understanding of the truth. A game, as we'll discover, that can often rely upon flattery. We begin, as one always should, with a story. Here's the story Perry tells, modified to make it, I like to think, more vivid than Perry's version. This story used to be one of my standard shticks, but I haven't told it in several years. Let's see if I'm still up to it. The story takes place on the Harvard campus, and we're following the fortunes of a student we can call Metzger. One day he was going over to the theatre for a rehearsal with his student dramatics society, but when he got there he found a sign saying that for some reason or other the rehearsal was cancelled. Come back next week. So what do you do then? You just walk aimlessly around the place, killing time, looking for something to do. And Metzger was lucky. He came across a friend of his. What are you up to? He asked. I'm just going to take a test for a sociology class, the friend said. I was sort of interested in sociology, Metzger said. What do you study in that class? Oh, it's a class on problems of the inner city, said the friend. We have to read all these books and then report on the ways the authors handle the various problems in various inner cities. Now, at this point, they had arrived at the door of the examination room where the friend was to have his test. As they stood there, the adjudicator of the test came and ushered everyone in, gently pushing Metzger, too, into the room. Well, Metzger, as we know, had some free time, and so, with what Perry calls a puckish grin, Metzger went in, sat down, and was given a test booklet and the questions, and began to take the test. The first part of the test consisted of multiple-choice questions about the contents of the three books the students were being tested on. Apparently, back in those days, multiple-choice questions were acceptable even at a place like Harvard. They never were at Amherst, I can tell you. Metzger gave random guesses to these questions. Then he went on to the essay question, which asked students to choose one of the three books and explain the author's views on how to tackle inner-city problems. Two of the books had obscure titles, which Metzger could not get a grip on, but the third book seemed easy. It was called something like Sociological Approaches to Minority Cultures in Our Cities. It was written by someone called Jeffrey Stanley. Metzger began his work, ready to gamble on an answer. What else could he do but gamble, take a risk? He based his answer on one bluff. This author spelled his name Jeffrey, G-E-O-F-F-E-R-Y, Stanley, S-T-A-N-L-E-I-G-H. Metzger figured that only someone from the Anglo-white privileged classes would have a name like that, and that's where he got his clue. He figured the book must have some value or else it would never have been assigned, but what else could he say? Here was his answer. Stanley's book seems to me an outstanding sociological document. It sets out clearly all the criteria a sociologist should draw upon when approaching a social problem, and it examines a wide variety of evidence drawn from a wide variety of sources, weighing each piece of evidence according to the sociological criteria previously set out for us. This illuminating methodology was, at least for me, an eye-opener and helped clarify just how meticulous and impartial the sociologist must be. Okay, what has Metzger said so far? Nothing, really, but he was on a roll. And here's his real success. He knew that no book should be praised without also weighing the book's deficiencies. And so Metzger proceeded like this, remembering that Stanley undoubtedly came from a background far removed from the people he was writing about. I cannot conclude my discussion of Stanley's weighty tome without voicing a serious and very important reservation I have about the book. Stanley speaks well about the abstract problems and solutions of the inner cities, but he writes like someone who has never actually experienced life in the inner city. His analysis is entirely theoretical, and if he cites specific cases, he does so in a dry, intellectual way. There's no humanity in this book, which is odd because it purports to be speaking about the lives of real human beings. That, at any rate, is a rough sense of how Metzger wrote his essay. He signed his name on the front of the booklet as J. Smith, handed the booklet in, and left the room. No doubt, to go back to his friends and laugh over what he'd just done. A week later, the test results were posted. Most students received a C. Metzger got an A-, and the examiner commented, "Very good analysis of the pros and cons of this book. Perhaps you could have brought in more examples from your text to support the point." Well, of course, Metzger could not bring in examples. He'd never read the book. And he let everyone know this. You can imagine the uproar that ensued. But what was the issue here? Perry, a sociologist, remember, and therefore interested in human behavior, was fascinated by this story and turned it into a sociological study. He defines Metzger's actions as bull. He's too polite to say bullshit. To bull is, Perry says, to discourse upon the contexts, frames of reference, points of observation that show the meaning of your data, if you had any data. You engage in bull, Perry's definition goes on, in the hope that the reader may be deceived into supposing your familiarity with the content. In other words, we bull when we talk fluently with a proper sense of how an expert would approach and analyze a subject, but we have no actual knowledge of the subject. We talk like an expert without knowing anything in the attempt to bluff someone into thinking we know what we're talking about. Perry opposes bull to another approach to a subject, which he calls cow. To cow is just to provide a list of data without any attempt to find the significance of the data. It is based, Perry says, on the assumption that a fact is a fact. When you give cow, you are presenting evidence of hard work as a substitute for understanding, without any intent to deceive. It turned out that most of the students had cowed the test, thinking that all they had to do was repeat what the book had said. Metzger, however, bulled the test, giving interpretation and analysis without any substance. This would be a fine example of chutzpah, except that Metzger wasn't trying to get anything out of it. He was just playing the examsmanship game. What a clown.
Fee, fee, fi, fi, fo, fo, fum. I smell smoke in the auditorium. Charlie Brown, he's a clown. Charlie Brown, he's gonna get caught. Just you wait and see.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
Him on his knees, I know that's him, yelling 7-come-11 down in the boys' gym. Charlie Brown, he's a clown, that Charlie Brown, he's gonna get caught, just you wait and see.
Why is everybody always picking on me?
Who's always writing on the wall? Who's always goofing in the hall? Who's always throwing spitballs? Guess who?
Who, me?
Yeah, you!
Who walks in the classroom cool and slow? Who calls the English teacher daddy-o?
Always picking on me.
There, just a little break with the Coasters and Charlie Brown messing around with school regulations, like Metzger messing around with the expectations of Harvard's testing system. So, Metzger bulled, speaking intelligently about the subject without knowing anything about the subject itself, while most of the rest of the class cowed, knowing all the information, but unable to speak intelligently about this information. And here was a problem for the noble academics of Harvard's sociology department. Morally, the issue was quite clear. The cow students wrote in good faith. They had read the books, had studied well, and had earnestly spewed back what they had studied. Good little boys. No girls at Harvard at this time. Metzger, however, was deceitful. He tried to fool the readers into thinking he had done the work when he hadn't. The cow students were moral. Metzger was immoral. But it wasn't as simple as that. Was Harvard there to evaluate the students' morality or to evaluate their intellectual abilities? If it was their intellectual abilities, then the cow students really should have failed. They showed no idea of how to think about a subject. They didn't even seem to know that analysis, interpretation, or developing a main point were part of the deal. Metzger, however, demonstrated a fine command of the thinking abilities. He knew what one should do when approaching an issue, and in doing so, he showed that if he ever had any facts on hand, he would know what to do with them. Did that justify his getting such a high grade on the test? Well, the poor man who marked Metzger's test had been so frustrated by all the cow answers he had to read through that when he came across Metzger's bull answers, his spirit suddenly picked up. Here at last was a potential colleague, a scholar in the making. Perry offers us this conclusion. Good bull, if undetected, gets an A, but if it is detected, it gets an F. And that seemed to settle the problem. Harvard grades according to intellectual ability. It does not grade according to morality, unless it is detected to be outright lying. Harvard is not out to teach morality. Or is it? Here, the matter becomes a little more complicated, a little more fascinating, a little more important. It has to do with the whole issue of how we perceive what the world is like and what we understand truth to be. Bear with me. The point is that the cow mentality thinks that facts themselves are valuable as knowledge. The more facts you have, the more knowledge you have. As Perry says, the foundation of this entire life is the proposition that a fact is a fact. The necessary correlate of this proposition is that a fact is either right or wrong. So that's the cow mentality. It's very simple. A fact is either right or wrong. The bull mentality has learned, though, that things are more complex. A fact has no meaning unless we see it in what Perry calls a frame of reference, that is, in some kind of context, to show how this fact is related to that fact, and all these facts can be connected in some way that leads to our further understanding of what's going on. The bull mentality has grasped the importance of this frame of reference. Here, then, Perry says, good bull appears not as ignorance at all, but as an aspect of knowledge. It is both relevant and true. In a university setting, good bull is therefore of more value than facts, which, without a frame of reference, are not even true at all. Okay, here's a fact to illustrate what we mean here. Columbus discovered America in 1492. Every American school kid learns this, or up until recently learned it. Is this a fact? Is it true? Sure, as a simple statement, it may be true, but it has no meaning, no truth, until it is put into a context. Watch the way each of the words in this sentence open up all sorts of complications when we put it into context. Columbus? Was that his name? He called himself Cristoforo Colombo, or Cristoforo Colon. Columbus was the Latinized version of his name, a formal name as a European figure, though he never, as I understand it, never used that name himself. So is it right to refer to a man by a name he himself never used? He discovered America? Yes, 25 years or more ago, this verb would have been simply accepted. But we all question it now. Discovered? You mean it wasn't there before and he found it? Ask the native peoples living there. Oh, thanks for finding us. We must have been lost all these years. From these people's perspective, a better verb might be not discovered, but invaded. And yet, let's not be too smug in our dismissal of the Eurocentric view of the matter. For centuries, Europeans, including, of course, Dante, thought that the world consisted of Europe and a part of what we now call Africa and Asia. Can you imagine what it must have felt like to learn that there were, after all, huge stretches of beautiful, rich land across the ocean that they never knew existed? See, as respectable thinkers, we have to keep both the idea of invasion and discovery in mind. Columbus discovered America. Is that accurate? Columbus did not know that he had landed in the American continent, or rather on an island off this continent. He thought he had struck land in India. Is it right, then, to say he had discovered something when he had a misconception about what it was he was doing? And what about other explorers from Europe, like Leif Erikson, who had landed on the American continent sometime before Columbus? Why do they not count as discovering the place? All these questions can be answered, of course. And in answering them, we take into consideration the whole sweep of European cultural assumptions, understanding much more about different ways of looking at facts, and even perhaps learning that a fact can lead us to several different ways of understanding the significance of that fact. Columbus discovered America in 1492? 1492? By which calendar? Europe was using a different calendar in those days from the one we use today. A date has meaning only in the context of the particular calendar it is connected to. Well, you get the picture. Contrast this complex way of interpreting the fact, recognizing shades of meaning and conflicting but perhaps reconcilable points of view, contrast it with the cow mentality, which sees a fact as either right or wrong. Columbus discovered America in 1428? Wrong. Columbus discovered America in 1492? Right. Simple as that. Right or wrong? True or false? The world's easily divided, and we know where we are. It's us and them, and of course we are right and true, they are wrong and false. So let's wipe them out. Uh-huh. You see what's happened? This apparently intellectual discussion has turned back into a moral discussion. The cow mentality leads, we see, to an attitude of right and wrong opposition, and eventually to war, or at least to oppression of some kind. We, of course, are seeing it all around us at the moment. The bull mentality, at its best, prepares us to see the other point of view and to negotiate. This is the way of peace. It is, dare I say it, the truly moral approach to the facts of the world. The great nations of Europe and America following them have more often chosen the oppositional approach rather than the peaceful approach, as Randy Newman bitingly tells us here.
The great nations of Europe had gathered on the shore. They conquered what was behind them, but now they wanted more. So they looked to the mighty ocean, they took to the western sea, the great nations of Europe in the 16th century.
Hide your wives and daughters, hide the groceries too. Great nations of Europe coming through. The Grand Canary Islands, first land in which they came. They conquered all the canaries there, which gave the land its name. There were natives there called Guanches, Guanches by the score. But bullets diseased the Portuguese, and they weren't there anymore. Now they're gone, they're really gone. You never seen anyone so gone. They're pictured in a museum, some lines written in a book. But you won't find a live one, no matter where you look. Hide your wives and daughters, hide the groceries too. Great nations of Europe coming through. Columbus sailed for India, found Salvador instead. He shook hands with some Indians there, soon they all were dead. They got TB and typhoid and athlete's foot diphtheria. The church told him were gay, so he had them torn apart by dogs on religious grounds. They say the great nations of Europe were quite holy in their way. Now they're gone, they're really gone. You never seen anyone so gone. Some bones hidden in the canyon, some paintings in a cave. There's no use trying to save them. Nothing left to say. Hide your wives and daughters, hide your sons as well. But the great nations of Europe never can tell. From where you and I are standing at the dawn of a century, Europe's have sprung up everywhere as anyone can see. But there on the horizon is a possibility. Some
Great or Great Nations of Europe from Randy Newman's songbook album, his way of getting more income by redoing his songs with only piano accompaniment. The song takes the traditional facts about European colonization, which once was so flattering to European and white American egos, and sees them from a different point of view. A bullshit song, we might say, but now we know what bullshit is all about. And what else can we say about flattery here? Cow can flatter simply by providing the facts that please the listener and hiding the others. And if you never question the context of what is presented to you as a fact, then you are, of course, much, much more susceptible to having alternative facts presented to you. Statements that aren't even factual, much less true. You've fallen for flattery and you've placed yourself in their hands. No relationship, no community, just wallowing in the shit they're feeding you. Bull can flatter too. In fact, it usually does. I bullshit you in order to deceive you about my knowledge, so you will give me more credit than I deserve. I can get away with it much of the time, but I'm still full of shit. And Dante shows us the true state of my soul, at least the state of my soul in those moments when I am bullying you. And that's about it for this evening's Evening Under Lamplight. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and I've enjoyed our time together here on Cambridge 105. You're a lovely audience, so bright, so intelligent, so good-hearted. And if you think that's bullshit, well, give it another thought.